It's the Onion Radio News. God refloods the Middle East. This is Doyle Redland reporting. In what theological and meteorological authorities are calling a wrathful display of Old Testament proportions, the Lord Almighty reflooded the Middle East today. The Creator of all things made the decision to go ahead with His second great flood after last-ditch U.S.-Saudi peace initiatives were rejected at the 11th hour. Harley Minogue is a non-denominational spokesman for the all-powerful being.
God only promised humanity that He would never again flood the entire earth. He never said He wouldn't flood specific areas.
Though regretful about the severity of God's punishment, Mideast peace negotiators nonetheless praised Him for coming up with the first ever viable solution to the ongoing crisis. Doyle Redland for the Onion Radio News.
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman, and for those who are just tuning in, we're listening to The Sins of Wall Street with Bloomberg News financial journalist Bob Ivory, who talks with Francesca Rhiannon about his book, The Seven Sins of Wall Street, Big Banks, Their Washington Lackeys, and the Next Financial Crisis.
One question that I have on this issue is, why don't they just jail? I mean, back in the, you know, under the Bush administration, you had the famous perp walk. You had a bunch of guys who went to jail. It didn't crash the economy, and in some cases, it didn't even crash the company. So what I don't understand is, are they really sincere about this? Well, you know, we don't want to prosecute these banks because we're afraid of what it's going to do to the economy. Why don't they just prosecute some of the guys at the head of it?
I can give you a cynical response, and that is that it's really provided by our own Congress. If you go back a couple of years to when Chase lost at least $6 billion on a scenario very close to what I just described, taking the savings accounts of ordinary Americans and kind of putting it on black and letting the roulette wheel spin and then losing the money. We don't know how much they lost because they won't account for it, but it's at least $6.2 billion. And they hauled the CEO of the company, Jamie Dimon, for hearings at both the Congress and the Senate. And the senators ended up asking for investment advice. I'm not sure why we should be puzzled that the executive branch of our government doesn't go after these guys, because a lot of them want jobs with these guys after they get out of their government service. If not them, then law firms that do a lot of business with them. I wish I could be less cynical about this, but that's really how I see it.
Like the law firm that Eric Holder comes from, Covington Burley, is that it?
That's right.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Bob Ivory about his book, The Seven Sins of Wall Street, Big Banks, Their Washington Lackeys, and The Next Financial Crisis. So the Federal Reserve is something that you go into to a great extent in The Seven Sins of Wall Street, and I have to say, I have not understood what the Federal Reserve was doing well until I read your book. It was a really fascinating story that you tell. You say that Ben Bernanke actually reshaped the U.S. financial system. How did he do that?
Well, thank you for that. That's very nice. I did write the book for folks who aren't, you know, neck deep in the financial industry. I wanted smart people everywhere to figure out the details. The Federal Reserve is the bank for banks. It lends money to the banks. It holds money for banks in accounts, savings accounts that are similar to savings accounts. And it tells the banks when they should be lending and more, when they should be lending less. And it slaps the banks on the wrist when they do things that aren't kosher. Ben Bernanke was the chairman of the Federal Reserve, the head guy in charge, probably the most powerful financial person in the world for 8 years under two presidents. He was nominated for that job by George W. Bush, and then he was renominated by Barack Obama. And when I say he reshaped the financial system, what he did after the financial crisis, and my book, The Seven Sins of Wall Street, really does focus on what happened after the financial crisis, is he decided to keep the bailout going. And it's not a very complicated process. It sounds complicated when the financial press and the folks in the financial industry start talking about it. But it's a policy called quantitative easing. And all it means is that the Federal Reserve, the bank for banks, is going to buy bonds from the banks. And what this does is it puts cash, fresh cash into the financial system. Now, it's not paying the banks. It's not giving away the money. It is buying securities. What securities? It's buying mortgages, mortgage-backed securities, to keep the mortgage industry going, and it's buying treasuries. So what happens is the treasury, the U.S. government, issues debt. It's going to borrow some money. So they issue bonds, the banks buy the bonds, lending money to the treasury, and then the Federal Reserve buys those bonds from the banks. So the banks lend money and then get money. So there's a lot of cash now. It's not tied up in securities anymore. It's not tied up in an investment like a treasury bond or a mortgage-backed bond. It's cash. And a lot of that cash is sloshing through the banking system. What Ben Bernanke thought was it would trickle down into the broader economy through loans mostly, or direct investment in some cases. But it didn't. That's because the banks like to have some money. That's what bankers are in the business for. They like money. And this was really cheap money.
And how is it cheap money? I mean, how does this work out that the banks are getting some kind of advantageous spread?
Well, they get to, you know, you're talking about a spread, right? So they'll buy, they're buying low and they're selling higher.
To the U.S. government? They're buying low from the U.S. government and selling high back to the government?
Yeah, the government is able to borrow money from the banks and then have the banks then sell those bonds or that debt back to the Federal Reserve. And let's not make the mistake and say that the Federal Reserve is part of the U.S. government, because it really, really isn't. It's something different. The Federal Reserve is its own thing. And one of the things that came out of 2008 was, if you didn't already realize how unaccountable the Federal Reserve is to Washington and to the taxpayers, you really knew that after 2008 and 9, because the Federal Reserve is only accountable to the banks. The big banks and the other banks in the country own shares. So you're really talking about a closed loop of the banking system.
But the Federal Reserve is printing U.S. money, isn't it? I mean, that's what people say. The Federal Reserve is printing U.S. dollars.
What they mean is that the Federal Reserve is buying these bonds from the banks and sending them cash. There's another component to it, and it's called ZIRP. ZIRP stands for Zero Interest Rate Policy. What the Federal Reserve did in December 2008 was it set the benchmark interest rate, the rate that banks lend to each other, at which banks lend to each other, at near zero. So what that did was that's what made money so cheap. So the banks could borrow money at 0.25% and then pay you in your bank, in your check savings account, 0.01%. And that was what was happening in 2012 was your bank account, your savings account, was paying you 0.01%. The banks were able to buy and sell money for very, very cheap. The cost of funding, they call it in banking, was very low and has remained low. And this is the upshot of that, is that 5.5 years later, the interest rates are still near zero. This is an unprecedented experiment in monetary policy. This has never happened before, that the Federal Reserve has set interest rates at near zero, meaning that those folks who are on the upper part of the pyramid can get their money nearly for free.
Hi, I'm Steve Lerman. I'm the guy that produces, edits, narrates, and promotes great speeches and interviews. I'm the guy responsible for airing in-depth interviews, speeches, and even debates on controversial subjects such as war and peace and climate change and the economy. I hope you like listening to it as much as I like producing it. Access Sacramento broadcasts it on the internet every Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m. And you can find the podcast at greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com as well as at Facebook.
When the president talks to God, are the conversations brief or long? Does he ask to rape our women's rights and send poor farm kids off to die? Does God suggest an oil hike when the president talks to God? When the president talks to God, are the consonants all hard or soft? Is he resolute all down the line? Is every issue black or white? Does what God say ever change his mind when the president talks to God? When the president talks to God, does he fake that drawl or merely nod? Agree which convicts should be killed, where prisons should be built and filled, which voter fraud must be concealed when the president talks to God? When the president talks to God, I wonder which one plays the better cop. We should find some jobs, the ghetto's broke. No, they're lazy, George, I say we don't. Just give them more liquor stores and dirty coke. That's what God recommends. When the president talks to God, do they drink near beer and go play golf? While they pick which countries to invade, which Muslim souls still can be saved? I guess God just calls a spade, when the president talks to God. When the president talks to God, does he ever think that maybe he's not? That voice is just inside his head when he kneels next to the presidential bed? Does he ever smell his own bullshit when the president talks to God? I doubt it. I doubt it.
And now back to The Sins of Wall Street with Bob Ivory and Francesca Rhiannon.
So you say that this has led to some inflation. Am I right about that?
This is some controversy, and I've worked with people, very smart people, who say, oh, you know, you're telling me about inflation. You know, anybody who's taken Economics 101 in college, which I didn't do, by the way, but every one of them will tell you, you put more money into the system, that means there's going to be inflation because you have more money. You're going to have higher wages, you're going to have higher prices, you're going to have more demand for goods and services, and that's going to push the prices of everything up. Well, we haven't seen that. Not really. Now, I happen to think that, and this is a minority opinion, and you can call me a crackpot for saying this, but I think that some of the data that the Federal Reserve uses to set their policy, in other words, certain numbers that Janet Yellen, who's now the chairperson of the Federal Reserve, that she looks at before she decides what monetary policy will be, I think they're a little off. For instance, it seems to me that with college education costs going up every year, with the cost of healthcare going up every year, and other things going up, the price going up every year, that there should be inflation. What I am told by people who are much smarter than me is that wages haven't gone up. And when wages start to go up, which seems to be the case perhaps now in May of 2014, that wages are starting to go up, you're going to start to see inflation. How much inflation? I had a very, very smart colleague in 2009 who told me he saw hyperinflation in the future. Hyperinflation is really dangerous because that means that people on fixed incomes, for instance, go broke. They go hungry. And just in my very surface study of financial history of the 20th century, it seems that hyperinflation is what's caused a lot of civil unrest, more so than just about any other financial calamity.
Bob Ivory. His book is The Seven Sins of Wall Street, Big Banks, Their Washington Lackeys, and the Next Financial Crisis. We'll talk more after the break. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're spending most of the hour today with financial reporter Bob Ivory. His book, The Seven Sins of Wall Street, is a ferociously tragicomic expose of how the U.S. taxpayers' bailout of Wall Street has resulted in the big banks getting bigger, our economy more fragile, and ordinary Americans more at risk. Writer and former financial analyst Nomi Prince said, Ivory's voice is appropriately sardonic and exasperated, his journalism and research impeccable. Now, this is also a story about financial journalism, which is just fascinating as well, finding out what the Federal Reserve, the banks, and the U.S. government really wants to keep secret. Tell us about your colleague Mark Pittman, along with Bloomberg here, suing the Federal Reserve to find out how much the Fed had actually given the banks, and the numbers are staggering.
Yeah, you know, when we talk about financial bailout, we usually talk about TARP. It's the Troubled Asset Relief Program, and it was administered by the U.S. Treasury under Secretary Henry Paulson. Now, it was for $700 billion to lend banks money in order to get through a tough patch. The Federal Reserve, on the other hand, lent out $1.2 trillion on a single day in December of 2008. But we wouldn't have known that if it hadn't been for Mark Pittman. Now, Mark Pittman was a reporter at Bloomberg News, a colleague of mine, and a frequent co-author of articles. He said, you know what? We know the Federal Reserve is lending money out because the number is reported every week in aggregate on the Fed's website. The Fed would say, basically, and I'm shorthanding it here a little bit, we lent out $400 billion this week. They didn't say to who, and they didn't say to how much to who, just an aggregate number. Mark said, well, this is our money, and we really should know. So he made a what's called a FOIA request. It's a Freedom of Information Act from the 1960s and allows citizens and reporters to petition the executive branch of the federal government. And there's local laws that govern local governments, but this was the Federal Freedom of Information Act. And you could ask them to provide information that should be public but isn't. They turned Mark down twice, and Mark went to his editor, and the editor went to his the lawyer, and the editor also went to his or her boss. And together they decided to sue the Federal Reserve to find out exactly how much the bailouts were, the details of it, which banks were borrowing money, for how much. And it took 2 years to wind through the courts. The courts never ruled against Bloomberg and Mark Pittman. The courts unanimously, three of them, said that the public interest of knowing this outweighed any kind of stigma that might attach to a bank that was borrowing money from the Federal Reserve.
Which was the argument of the Federal Reserve.
The Federal Reserve said that if you knew who was borrowing, then that bank would be stigmatized, that counterparties would pull their deals, that depositors would pull their deposits, that lenders would pull their lines of credit and stop lending. And the court said, no, there's a public interest to knowing this. And finally, the Federal Reserve decided not to fight it all the way to the Supreme Court. What had happened was, after the first court case that the Federal Reserve lost, the big banks, in the form of a organization called the Clearinghouse, joined the Federal Reserve in the suit. So the Federal Reserve and the biggest banks in the country, their interests were now clearly aligned in court. And Bloomberg, this poor little organization, this media organization with billions of dollars behind it and the world's best lawyers and probably the best financial reporter in the country, Mark Pittman, prevailed. And unfortunately, Mark died before the case was settled. He died in November 2009, and the case wasn't settled until much later. But we were able to, because of his work and because of the Freedom of Information Act, we were able to show that the CEOs of all six of the biggest banks in the United States basically lied to their investors and to the public about the health of their organizations. We could show, for instance, that Ken Lewis, who was the CEO of Bank of America, was telling investors that everything was peachy with his bank. And that same week, he had $60 billion out in loans from the Federal Reserve. Now, these loans are meant to help banks get over a hump, a bad patch. A liquidity shortage is what they call it in the banking system. But what we could see was a pattern that even the biggest banks, Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan Chase, Morgan Stanley, these were really, really big liquidity problems. In other words, when you borrow $100 billion on a single day, like Morgan Stanley did, or $98 billion, like Bank of America did, or $95 billion, like Citigroup did, what you've done basically is you have reshaped the financial system to say, it doesn't matter how much you screw up, we're going to bail you out. And this was Mark Pittman's gift and Bloomberg News's gift to the knowledge we have about 2008 and 2009.
If they're getting so much money and they're being underwritten by the U.S. taxpayer and they've got this great advantageous spread between, you know, the money that they're borrowing and what they're selling back to the Federal Reserve or to the U.S. government. Well, why wouldn't they keep on borrowing this money at such a cheap amount, even if they are healthy, because they're making money off of it? I mean, is it really that they're not healthy, or is it just that they're gaming the system because they know it's such a sweet deal?
I think that's a very smart question, and I think it's something that we talked about and we wrote about in 2009, 2010, 2011. Because, you know, you had different programs that the Federal Reserve ran. This wasn't just, you know, you belly up to the window and you say, I need $100 billion, and they give it to you. There were many different programs designed to save certain industries and to help the banks in certain sectors of their functioning. For instance, the Federal Reserve wanted to stimulate mortgage borrowing, so it had a program where it would, if you used your mortgage bonds as collateral, it would lend you money for very, very cheap. We found out that Goldman Sachs had borrowed, I think it was $15 billion. It was a $15 billion loan from the Federal Reserve in exchange for mortgage-backed securities as collateral. And this, in theory, would make Goldman go out and buy more mortgages in order to have collateral to get this loan. And they were getting this loan for, believe it or not, 0.01% interest. So it was as close to free money as you possibly can. And our discussions at Bloomberg News about this was, do you really think that Goldman needed this $15 billion, or they just saw this opportunity to get some really cheap funding? So yeah, I think that they never came out and said it. They said, oh, we didn't need the money. And just about every bank came out and said that. We didn't need this money. They gave us some malarkey about, or we want to test the plumbing, make sure that the loan process worked. We're doing the Federal Reserve a favor by testing the plumbing of the financial system to make sure that when we apply for the loan, everything works okay and we get the cash.
When we flush your dollars down the toilet.
Yeah, yeah, it's the plumbing analogy can get really raunchy, but, and I won't pursue it, but I think that you did have a combination of at times needing the money in order to get over a rough patch, and at other times just taking advantage of some really cheap money that if you're a banker, well, if you're anybody, if I said to you, I'll give you a $15 billion loan and I won't charge you for it, why not?
So you also talk about this issue of saving. You referred to savings accounts before. I think you use grandma as your grandma's deposits, and what the banks are doing with them. We have FDIC, this Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, that's supposed to basically insure our deposits up to $250,000. Putting that together with what you've just said, you know, the questions as to the health of the banks, I'd like to ask you, are our deposits safe? Is the FDIC safe, secure?
I don't know. I would like to believe so, but I think that you're starting to really put your finger on the heart of the problem of too big to fail. You see, we had something called Glass-Steagall. That was a law from the 1930s, from the Depression, from the stock market crash. And what it said was, you have one bank for deposits, for grandma, as I say, and the other bank is for the casino. And that's where bankers can underwrite equities, they can underwrite bonds, they could buy credit default swaps or collateralized debt obligations. And they could roll the dice at the casino, the financial casino. And so we had a separation. We had a wall between the deposits and the casino. And in 1999, Bill Clinton signed a law that said we're going to just wipe out the wall. There was a little bit of a protection in the Federal Reserve Act. And I go into that in some detail in the book. Let's suffice to say that the Federal Reserve did all it could to erase that protection between the casino and grandma's account, because that's really what we're talking about, is that savings accounts are a really cheap way for the bank to fund itself. It hardly pays any interest on a certificate of deposit or a savings account. And that's how the bank funds its forays into the casino. That's okay now. It didn't used to be okay. It's okay now, and the Federal Deposit Insurance, the FDIC, does not like that. Because what the FDIC ends up doing is it ends up, as you can see, guaranteeing the bank at the casino. If the bank's using deposit money at the casino and that money's lost, then the FDIC's on the hook to pay back the depositors.
Good evening, good evening. I am a reporter for Al Jazeera, the Arab News Network. And I am here this evening to dispel the ugly rumors that our broadcast contains secret messages intended for terrorists. That is not true. Our broadcasts are straight, just like your Fox TV. No. It's not true. We Arabs, we love your people. We love the USA. It is true. Actually, I have a little song to sing for you that will prove that. But first, I'd like to introduce my special assistant, Falala Smith. That's her married name. Yes, she is the winner of the Al Jazeera Wet Burqa Contest. She has a lovely figure. Trust me on this. All right, shall we begin? Al Al Jazeera, jolly Al Jazeera. Al Jazeera, love the USA. You sing along with me now. Yes, you know this tune, huh? It's old Arab tune. Here we go. Al Jazeera, jolly Al Jazeera. Al Jazeera loves the USA. Afghan president is calm. Hope we don't see Karzai bomb. Karzai bomb! Karzai bomb! Oh, oh, sing along. Al Jazeera, jolly Al Jazeera. Al Jazeera loves the president. We're in Cuban prison cells, locked in yours, not infidels. Infidels! Karzai bomb! Here we go again! Al Jazeera, jolly Al Jazeera. Al Jazeera loves the USA. Arab views are not so mean. That's how views in Gaza lean. In gasoline! Infidels! Karzai bomb! Here we go again. Al Jazeera, jolly Al Jazeera. Al Jazeera loves the USA. For Iraq's rebuilding path, pick a leader, take a bath. Take a bath in gasoline. Infidels, Karzai bomb. Jazeera, jolly Al Jazeera. Al Jazeera loves the USA. Salam, salam,
and now, messages from Access Sacramento.